May 23rd, 2002, Oral History Committee of SABR, Society for American Baseball Research. Evelyn Begley is a member interviewing Lawrence Ritter, author of The Glory of Their Times, and the best interviewer that SABR has ever known for oral interviews, especially of players. I have a series of questions to ask you on behalf of SABR's Oral History Committee, and most of them involve doing interviews and writing baseball books.
Okay.
Now, before I begin questioning, do you have any opinions that you'd like to share that are general opinions on
about
how
the
to
Republican
do
Party?
Or Democrat or Socialist? But mostly about having a party, interviewing people, and eliciting the best of them.
I don't think it's so easy to just say what my opinions are, but I think this probably they will come out in the course of talking to us, talking to each other.
And when you interview people specifically for The Glory of Their Times, you once told me that they were very willing to talk because their relatives were sick and tired of hearing the stories and no one wrote the stories down for them.
That's correct.
And who's writing your story? Has anyone written your story?
A lot of people have written magazine articles and stuff like that.
About you?
Yeah, they're all over the place.
Where were you born and when?
Marty Appel did the most recent one for Sports Collectors Digest. You know, of course, Sports Collectors Digest?
I know of it and I've read some issues.
Marty wrote a page on that, about the board for their time. He was the last one to do it. Lee Lowenthal wrote a thing. Don't want to remember where it appeared. Daryl Berger also wrote one, also for the Sports Collection Digest. I can't remember, but there were several others. And now, as you know, next week, David Mogbielik is wants to interview me about the tapes. Which I presume will go into the Brand New Fair. So, yes, there's a lot of things to do. I get so tired of people.
When were you born? Where? And how did you develop that sense of humor?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1922, May 23rd, which is my birthday today.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
And what influenced you growing up to develop the love you have for the game of baseball?
My father was a big baseball fan and a boxing fan, and it's no accident that the only two sports that I that really I'm engaged with are baseball and boxing. I hardly ever watch basketball, hockey, or football. But, you know, I'm very involved in what happens in both baseball, especially baseball, and to a much less extent, boxing. I like the boxing because people try to kill each other.
What are your memories of your father taking you to
doesn't
boxing?
Happen often in baseball. Do you remember when John Roseberg tried to hit Juan Marichal with his bat?
I've seen that on TV. What I saw live was Pete Rose and Bud Harrelson fighting.
Yeah, but that wasn't with a bat.
No, it wasn't. I saw Campaneras throw a bat at Lerman LeGros.
That's good. And we saw Sandy Alomar or his brother spit on the umpire. So those are things that big, like we had my pipe. Did pull a field's ear off. So, similarities between baseball and boxing. Okay, yes.
When your father took you to your first boxing match.
Yes, Tavi Moriello versus Billy Seuss, I do believe.
How do you spell those names?
Moriello. And since I had that stroke, I don't spell too good anymore. Mori, M-A-U-R-I-E-L-L-L. Moriello. Tammy, T-A-M-I.
Okay.
N-Y. And Billy Seuss, S-O-O-S-E. Now, that's my memory of it, and I know I have seen Billy Seuss fight, and I saw Tammy Moriello fight, but I might have not seen them fight each other. Those are the two that made a big impression on me, because Tammy Moriello fought Joe Louis subsequently, which is a big thing. Of course, Joe knocked him out, and Billy Seuss, my daddy always was very pleased to tell me that Billy Seuss had gone to Penn State, and that impressed him, and that also impressed me.
Because it was an Ivy League school?
No, because it was a college, and most boxers don't go to college.
And your father was in education?
My father was a school principal, and he was very hip on getting an education. And he was impressed because Billy Seuss had gone to Penn State. And Billy later became, for a while, middleweight champion of the world.
How old were you when you announced it?
That my boxing?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say about 12. But my first time I went to a baseball game, I was about 11. That's something
we're not too good. And was that at Yankee Stadium?
Yes, and as I told you before, my memory is that it was Yankee Stadium, Philadelphia Athletic versus the Yankees, and in my memory, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and Jerry Fox all hit home runs that day, but for the life of me, I have not been able to find in the record any game at Yankee Stadium. And it had to be in April or May or June that these two teams played, and Babe Ruth, Jim Fox, and Lou Gehrig all hit home runs. So I don't know. Might be partly my imagination or bad memory.
Or if you were 11, then that was 1933. It
yeah.
could have been either year before or after.
Yes.
Which is what you told me previously.
Yes.
Now, when you interviewed players, would you automatically include that question? Baseball? No, why not?
What's the question?
The question about their first baseball game.
No, I was more likely to ask them how they broke into baseball. How come they became? How did they get the first breaks? Somebody saw them. Remember now, as Chief Art Myver told me when I asked the chief, I said, did somebody, the scout, see you? That was in 1897 or 8, and 1897 or 8, not 19. And the chief, he puzzled them in the film, and he said, you're thinking modern, he said. I always remember the word. You're thinking modern. They didn't have no scouts in those days. You just did by sheer determination, you just put yourself there. Anyway, I never asked them how they started. I'm sorry, I never asked them about anything before my first, not first, but I would invariably get invariably get around to the subject of how you ever were signed or by your first correct professional team, rather than ask him about when I went to my first game.
Mm-hmm. And were there a set standard of questions that you had in the back of your mind, or you just let the players talk about whatever they want, wherever it went?
I had a number of questions, but I didn't have the order of the questions, because the most important thing for an interviewer is to listen. And if you listen and you respond and react, then as time goes on, the conversation veers off into different directions, and it doesn't stay on a straight line. But I had in the back of my head certain things I did eventually or early or later ask him about. And so I had those things in my head. But I didn't necessarily ask them like with a list.
What you found out was research, and there wasn't a total baseball available when you were doing
it. No, there was something very close to it. Perkin Compton had been published a couple of years earlier than that, and that was invaluable because I could find out from Perkin, you remember? You know Perkin?
Was that the brown book? I still have one of those old encyclopedias, a small little book.
Yes,
thick,
that's right.
Though.
Yes.
Right.
And Perkin Thompson had in it very brief, not like the encyclopedia or not like Total Baseball, had in it very brief statistics of everybody's major league career. And it also said, had in it two other important things, when he thought a book was born and whether he, well, it had date of death. So there was no date of death, that meant he was still alive and available. I mean, I could talk to this man, whoever he might be, whereas I said I could. So it was important that the encyclopedia had in it date of birth and death.
I looked up a name the other evening, Paul Volcker, on the internet, and I was actually able, 411.com and whoware.com, that I was able to get those websites from the Sabre member, Paul went, and once I got there, I was able to locate Paul Volcker, and that he lived in Manhattan.
And you even located that he lived on East 79th.
That's right, and he gave his phone number on the internet. But you didn't have an internet. How did you locate the players?
Oh, it was very, very, very difficult. I wrote a letter to the Hall of Fame, to Lee Allen, and told them what I was doing, and wanted to ask them maybe he had access at least to the members of the Hall of Fame, as well as maybe could give each other addresses as well, because after all, he had access to all of it. He kept the files at that time. And he wrote back and said, I'm sorry, but it's against the Hall of Fame's policy to release any addresses of anybody, either in or out of the Hall of Fame. So I'm very sorry I can't do that. He said, he said, maybe you might try looking in old phone books. He said, I know for a fact that in the New York Public Library, they have the phone books of virtually every town and hamlet in the whole United States. So if you know when people were born, which I did know because the date was given and place was given in certain countries, he said, if you know where people were born, in those days, he said, most of them stayed when they were through playing ball. Most of them stayed in the same locality where they grew up. and you can find him that way. And that's all he said. So I tried that, and it worked. And always, without fail, if I had a little, even a little town phone book, I would look, let's say, Crawford. I was looking for Sam Crawford. So he wasn't in the book. But there was other Crawfords in the book. So I called everybody named Crawford, and invariably I found somebody who said, yeah, he's our cousin or our uncle or something. And without fail, I got an address of how to locate all these people.
People weren't suspicious?
Never, not the slightest. That was a different era. Now you're talking about 1961 to 1965, and well, I don't know if it was different, an error, but no one was suspicious.
So that was a lot of expense
you
went to making the call, writing letters. I'm assuming you wrote
letters. Yes, I wrote a long letter explaining what I was doing, and when I would, I didn't make any phone calls first. I mean, to people, let's say Sam, I didn't call him. I wrote a letter to each of them, telling them what I was doing, and I would only do this before I was ready to take a trip and see these people. I would do that about 2 weeks before. I mailed a letter 2 weeks before, and I asked them, I said, okay, but then if I go and talk to them. I didn't mention a tape recorder, I just said, talk to them. And most all of them said yes, and by the way, when I came in with my great big Anderberg tape recorder, nobody said a word. They didn't care if I taped it or not, and that was surprising to me. I thought they would not want to have their words taped, but it didn't matter to them.
And you don't like the idea of interviewing someone by tape over the telephone?
Impossible. You can't look at the person and know what the person is thinking about, and that you don't really listen either on the telephone like you listen in person. So that what you do over the telephone is almost inevitably, you have a string of questions, and then you ask them and they answer them, and then you go on to the next question. Because if you're doing that sitting right in front of, with, next to the person might, usually, would say something closely related to whatever they were talking about, but it would remind them of something else, and that's how come the conversation would veer off in a whole bunch of different ways. You don't realize that unless you're sitting right in front of them.
The conversation
communicating
is what brings out the depth of people, not so much an interview, which is on the surface.
It's the conversation, not the interview.
And what gave you the idea to do the Glory of Old Time?
I had a son who I didn't get along with because I had been divorced, and he lived with his mother and came to visit me or lived with me on weekends, every second or third weekend. And let's see, it was 1960, so he was 12. And he was very into baseball. And I was too, a little bit then, a lot then, but not as much as I became after I finished the interview. And I'm trying to think of a way I could communicate with him, because kids who are roughly teenagers, they have no interests other than their friends and their, what their friends do do at school and all those things. You can't talk to them about these things because you don't know what's going on in their lives. So I hit on the idea of doing this book of interviews, interviewing all baseball players because he liked that game. And that I thought would help bring us together.
You came with you on all of your travels?
Most of them.
Most of them. How long did you do the traveling and interviewing from when to when?
From the beginning of the night. That started right after Ty Cobb died. And that's what gave me the idea. I was a historian at NYU, who was a very big baseball fan. His name, see, if I interview a ball player, after a while he just stopped until the fire engine or the ambulance went by, because that's not the beginning, but as we spent more time together, they didn't want me to miss anything. Yeah, they would all, this is typical. Anyway, what was I saying?
Colleague at NYU?
Oh, I had a colleague, big baseball fan. His name was Herman Cruz, K-R-O-O-S-S. And the name is on the back of, in the last acknowledgments in the glory of their time at the end of the book. And he said one day after Todd Carr died, when we were having lunch, he said, wow, there's a whole era of history disappearing before our very eyes. He said, you know, realize Babe Ruth is gone, Walter Johnson is gone, Chip Christy Mathewson is gone, Honoris Wagner was gone, Lou Gehrig was gone, and he said, somebody ought to take a tape recorder and get the memories of the people that are still here, because they're pretty soon an oldie gone. So that sounded intriguing to me, and then I matched it up with my needs to make contact with a teenager, and they came together, and so I started doing what I did, writing letters, writing Lee Allen, and after I got addresses from the phone books, writing to the ball players. Also, I would watch very carefully on the TV every old-timers game I could find, because invariably they interviewed the old-timers before game time, and what are you doing, and stuff, etc. And they would always ask, where are you living now? And so I got a lot of places where they're living. I didn't even have to go to the phone books. And that was easy.
You got to get him besides, too.
No, I was in it on radio or TV. I had to be home so I could write down very quickly exactly what they say. You didn't. Otherwise, I couldn't hear. They'd be on the radio or TV. So I had to be home, and I would know the Yankees old time of the day was Saturday, and I would be all ready when what's his name? The great announcer.
Red Barber.
My Mesher is not a great announcer. He doesn't compare to Red Barber. He's okay, but my ideal was Red Barber and what's his name in Detroit?
Ernie Harwell?
Yeah, they were my ideal.
Why didn't you interview them?
I never dream of it.
Would you, if you had the opportunity?
Later, I became a very good friend of Red Barber, but I never interviewed them.
What would you have asked him?
Oh, I don't know.
I know what I want to ask you.
What?
What made you such a great announcer?
Because that southern accent. Tell the truth.
Because you have to carry that, and he was very mature. You have to carry
What's his name in Detroit?
Ernie Harvey.
Ernie had the same voice.
Sure.
You can't tell them apart.
Right.
Oh, and finally, Vin Scully. They all sound the same. They all have a southern.
They sing.
Yes, that's right. And so, and that wasn't true for Rick Mallow. He didn't sing.
That's true, he didn't. And neither did Frank Mesa.
Absolutely not.
Or Phil White or Phil Rizzuto. That was more my deal.
No, not Phil.
No.
Not Phil Wright either. But I did love Rizzuto because he was such prop fun.
And a homer.
That's right.
I didn't care about that.
I liked his cannolis and stuff like that.
Birthday.
I thought that was great.
For a few innings, and then time to go on the CW bridge.
That's right. Yes, I liked him very much as a person, not so much as an announcer.
Right. You like people with a lighthearted sense of humor. Were you able to capture that in most of your interviews with
no.
ball players?
No.
But Chief Myers, you did.
Oh, yeah, and many of them, but not all.
No.
Some of them are serious people.
Lefty O'Doul seemed to take himself a little seriously, but maybe that was because he was running a restaurant for England.
Yes, he really didn't take himself very seriously, but he was doing 10 things at once, and the waiters were rushing around getting ready for the new rush, and he was always had one eye out if things were going smoothly and everything.
And you meant to come back and interview him, but
I went back many times, though I didn't interview him anymore.
Oh, what happened?
I became a friend, and when you become a friend, it's hard to interview. He can't anymore. Yeah, you can't ask him for an autograph anymore. You simply can't do it. Well, you could say that it was for a friend of mine that he autographed. But you can't. You get a totally different relationship. And I became very close to Lefty until he died. But he ran this very nice restaurant called Lefty O'Doul's at Geary and Powell Streets in San Francisco. And every Thanksgiving Day and every Christmas Day, Lefty would shut the doors of the restaurant, and the only people that were allowed in were street people. And I was honored to be there too, Lefty and his wife, and me, and all the three people, all the prostitutes, the derelicts, the panhandlers, everybody from the streets came in, and he served a big meal, and even at Christmas time, he gave everybody presents too. And so I used to go out at least 2 times a year to be there then.
He invited you every year?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We became very good friends. Although I must say, this is a story about Mr. DiMaggio. And when Lefty came to New York 1 year to get the Baseball Writers Award for Meritorial Service or something like that. And we were going up in an elevator to his room, and all of a sudden on the next floor, Joe DiMaggio got on the elevator, and you know that DiMaggio and O'Doul were very, very close because O'Doul was DiMaggio's first manager at San Francisco Seals. Yes. And so Lefty doing the stool, when the elevator came to his floor, it turned out it was DiMaggio's floor also. So Lefty said, "Joe, this is Larry Ritter. He's the writer who did the book Glory of Their Times." And so DiMaggio gave a little nod, like, "Is that so?" And then Lefty said, "Come on, we're going to my room and let's just have a couple of drinks and talk. And the manager didn't even answer. He just turned around and went the other direction because I was a writer. He had no love for writers anymore. Maybe he did it early in his career, but no more. And so that's my experience. That's an experience with Joe, although I had more experiences with him too, because I was such a good friend of Lefty's, who was his best friend. There's a story, an article, not a story, by the Gate Police that appeared, I think, in Head Dryer, about looking for DiMaggio. Did you ever read that?
I just read.
Yes, that's different. This is, he was looking for, he wanted to interview DiMaggio, which a lot of people have wanted to interview DiMaggio, and I don't think anybody succeeded at all. Anyway, so he went out to San Francisco to interview, went to the rest of LeBron on Fishville's wharf, and asked the brother, Joe's brother ran the restaurant, and asked him, you know, I'm Gay Police. Well, I'm not sure that he said Gay Police because that word has gotten. I'm Mr. Police, and I would like to talk to your brother. I remember I wrote him a letter, and his brother says, I don't know where he is. Anyway, the story is all about his adventures trying to track down Joe DiMaggio, and it's a very interesting magazine article.
I'd be curious, what was the tone of voice that Felice was using? Was he just reporting, or was he letting the reader become as frustrated? He must have become frustrated.
He was reporting in such a way as to force to let the reader become very sympathetic with the problem of trying to track down Joe DiMaggio.
And then later on that was made into a song, Where Have You Gone, Joe DiMaggio?
It wasn't related, that's right. That's right. And Joe always says, what do you mean? Where have I gone? He never could understand the song. Anyway, so that's how come up. We were talking about the duo, and we were talking
about that you like compassion and you like a sense of humor, and you're attracted to that when you interview.
Yes, well, I think everybody does. I'm not unusual in that respect. But we were saying something about the conversation.
It all started
with you asking, what about a phone interview.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work because you don't become friends or anything close to it if you do it on a phone, whereas if you do it in person, pretty soon you become simpatico.
That's the
precious
word.
Yes.
Sure. What you consider your best interview and why? I don't mean best in a technical sense. I mean, a feeling of satisfaction you got later when you just, there were no words you gave yourself, you just knew that this was so precious, so one of a kind.
I thought that happened many, many times. It's impossible to say the best one.
Mm-hmm.
It happened with Sam Crawford, because we spoke for days, and then I would go to the motel and we'd start again the next day. At least two full days, maybe more. And it happened with Fred Snodgrass, who told wonderful stories. And it happened with Chief Myers, who I got very close to. And it happened with David Jones. And it was a lot of people.
Any interview that you wish you could have done over? Or an interview you wish you could have had and just never got around to doing?
Oh yeah, there's several items that I wish I had had, but I never got around to doing. They were two people in particular, Buck Newsom, and Dazzy Vance. Both of those people, Newsom and I think his name was, people usually call him Bobo Newsom, and Dazzy Vance, were both well known as wonderful spinners of stories. And I would have loved to talk to them. I think one of them died, I think that's a bit Dazzy Vance, before I could get to him. And then I think Newsom, I was going to do it at some later time, but I never got around to it, and then he was gone.
Would you have wanted to do Dizzy Dean or
Mulberg? No. Dizzy Dean had died, I think. No, I wasn't interested much in Dizzy Dean. He was too commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried very hard to do Mulberg, because he lived right over here in Newark.
Oh.
And so I wrote a letter to him and asked him all about what I was going to do. And what he talked to me, and I never got any answer. And so I don't know how I found out, but he has had a brother who was either a dentist or a doctor, I forget which, in Newark. And I called up I think it was a dentist, finally, since I didn't get an answer from Mo. And I told his brother what I was doing. And his brother was very sympathetic, thought it was a wonderful idea, and Mo would love it. But I never heard from Mo at all. And then he was gone.
You sent follow-up letters? Was that difficult?
With him, I wanted him. I really wanted him because of his reputation as a scholar.
Oh, okay.
And very important, I thought, to get him. And when I finished The Glory of Their Times, I sent a copy to him. And care of his brother, who, by the way, whom he lived with. He had a room in his brother's house until his brother got sick of him, I might say, because Mo collected newspapers and didn't ever dispose of them, and he had stacks of them around the house. And finally his brother said, either the newspapers go or you go. And he went. Anyway, so I sent a copy of The Glory of Their Times, he was still alive, in care of his brother. And 5 years later, I got a phone call from his brother. He said, I was just going up, I guess it was after Mo died. He said, I was going through a lot of Mo's stuff, and I came across this book, which was still unopened. It was still in its wrapper. And I remembered your name and what you said you were doing, so I opened the wrapper and opened the book, and he said 3 hours later I was still reading it. And he said, Mo would have loved it. And he said, it's just a tragedy. Leave the phone up. It's just a tragedy. He never got the reason.
You would have sent it in newspaper wrappings.
He would have opened it up.
Opened
yes.
And newspaper clippings in each chapter.
877-3484.
Now, when Glory did come out, and many people realized that...
See, we have wandered way off the main topic, whatever it was. I don't remember the last thing we talked about.
We were talking about telephone interviews.
Okay, so we were saying...
Perfect, that's Debbie. And her brother.
Hello, Larry. You're not there.
From Germany.
And happy birthday to you from Berlin.
And happy birthday from Harry. Goodbye and have a good
professor.
They called from Germany. Wow, Berlin. Very nice. And he did get her flowers.
Anyway, what were you saying? That's, you know, if you have a phone conversation, a phone interview, there's no way you can get it into other subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And the other subjects are the interesting ones.
That's right. And the eye contact helps. And that's what I've learned from you about finding the right photographs for your other books, is to look for the life in the eyes.
Yeah, that's important.
Which you have to be
life.
In present. Yeah.
Yes.
And in somebody's presence to develop that. Now...
Oh, you asked about... The last thing you asked was people that I was, whose interview was, I thought, was very, very good. And I, as I said, I remember many, Tommy Leach was a wonderful interview. I mean, not all. Stanley Kowalewski was very taciturn. He gave one-sentence answers, because he was a very silent person. We got along very well, but he didn't talk much.
Some people are reserved.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And Stanley spent all his time fishing.
Oh.
So he wanted to be alone most of the time. And we got along great, and I enjoyed him and everything, but it wasn't what you'd call a wonderful interview, because there was not a lot there. But if you read it, you see that it was a very good interview. And other place, I interviewed Elmer Flick, who, as you know, led the league in home runs about 1905 or 6, with 5 or 7 or something like that. But he had Alzheimer's. It was unfortunate.
You knew then at
the
time?
No, I found out when I interviewed him that he didn't really know what was going on. And Heine Groh, who was a sweetheart, tried so hard to remember details. And he didn't do too well, but I always prompted. See, I had done a lot of homework before an interview. Several days of poring over the guy's record, who he had played with, who he had played against. I knew his life backwards and so forward. So Heine was so sweet and so apologetic when he couldn't remember stuff that I fed him stuff. I said, you know, wasn't it this way, or wasn't that working? Oh, yes, he'd say. So that was not what you call a great interview, although I became very good friends with him, but not a great interview. And then there was George Gibson. He was a catcher in the Pittsburgh Pirates. I think the first year he caught for them was about 1904 or 5. And then he caught for them until about 1915 or 16. And then he retired to Ontario, Canada, where he lived. And then he got a phone call from John McGraw and said I'd like you to be my coach. This coming year, and so George said yes, and then he talked all about being a coach, and then he became the manager of the Pirates, George Gibson, who did, and we talked for 2 days, and when I got home, I couldn't think of anything to say. He didn't say anything.
Just the chronology?
That's about it, and also, a lot of what he said I already had from Tommy Leach, who was his teammate. And how could I have the two people in the same book saying the same thing? So I left George. George, by the way, had a had two sons, both of which became medical doctors. Mm-hmm. And they lived in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I couldn't think of, he didn't say anything that Tommy Leach hadn't already said. So very, very, very reluctantly, in a very embarrassed I was, to not put it in a book.
I would have been embarrassed.
Oh, I was, I couldn't.
How did you handle that?
I couldn't face him. I never contacted him. I was terribly embarrassed.
Yeah,
it was after all those hours of torture, talking, and...
Well, I want to check the tape because I'll be embarrassed if the tape stopped.
Yeah.
Oh, it's still going.
Now, you were talking about George Gibson and that you wished you could have included his interview, but it was almost the same as Tommy Leach.
It was rambling and nothing interesting, really. It wasn't a good interview.
When it was included in the second edition, did you write to him? Was he still alive?
No, he was dead.
Oh, but you felt better.
Yeah, I did, and I sent the copy to his sons. As I said, he had two sons who were both physicians living in Pittsburgh. You know, that's where George spent almost all of his career. And they wrote back and said how pleased they were. And they sent me a huge team ticker picture of the 1909, I think the Pirates won in 1909. A huge team picture of the 1909 Pirates. And of course I never was a memorabilia collector. And I gave it away, and somebody, I think Richard Merkin, told me, gee, it was worth hundreds of dollars.
Now, you did an interview with Billy Werber, if you don't mind saying it again, well, we could save it for another time, but that is a funny story, that he rejected.
We can't do it again.
That'll wait.
It can't
be repeated.
No. Some other time I'd do it again. If we do it again, I'm trying to remember exactly what I said.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
The whole spontaneity of it. Lost.
That's right.
Which is another reason that phone interviews are no good. You don't, even if there is spontaneity, you don't know it because you don't see the person.
Right. Now, you became a celebrity after it was published.
Yeah.
And that, in essence, ended what you loved doing, which was the interviewing and making connections with these players and having their lifelong friendship. You couldn't do that anymore because
you were famous. No, I was friends with all of them, or almost all, close friends, until each of them passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And
also,
one reason I was so close friends is because I was, you know, I was doing very well. I was a professor and chairman of the Department of Finance at NYU. It's a big job. I was making a lot of money. Whole bunch of other consulting jobs. So, by the way, that at that time the tax rate above a certain level was about 80% of your income.
Wow.
I didn't want to give it to the government in order to fight the Vietnam War. So, we divided up the money equal, share and share alike. And so, when Billy Werber said he didn't want to be in the book, he lost a lot of money.
That's right. How much was the percentage for the players?
Equally, everything.
Equally, everybody.
There was 23 or 4 or 5,
mm-hmm.
and I took 2 shares, and everybody else took 1 share, and that was it.
And you arranged that with the publisher?
No, it was just my film.
Oh, you got the check and you divvied it up.
Yeah, it got to be such a drag because the person eventually, the person would die. But the money had to go to the heirs or the wife for the children.
Right.
After a while, I had so many places I was supposed to soon send the money that I thought in the middle of the 80s, I said, I wrote everybody a letter who was, or the heirs, and said, here, here's $500. That's it. I can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. And that was in the mid-80s.
Yeah. And everybody said, okay, except Harry Hooper's son, who said, my children, that is, Harry's grandchildren, they like the idea of getting the royalty checks, even though at that time it wasn't much, because a new edition, it was just come out, and it didn't really take off until later. And, I mean, really, it was not making peanuts at that time. So I was sending checks to each of Harry's grandchildren for like $22.50, and after a while...
The bookkeeping alone.
Yeah, so finally, and they had said he didn't wanted to keep up. So I did for about 5 years, and then I said, the hell with it, and I haven't done it since then. I'm waiting for a year from him. I think since today's my 80th birthday, I figured they
might call.
Yeah, they might call, but I figured they won't prosecute an old man who's had a stroke.
You had the stroke in July.
Yeah, July 31st.
It's almost a year ago. And you were in the hospital before for a heart attack? How did that improve?
No, that was long
what
ago.
Was
that was a mild heart attack. There wasn't much.
That didn't interfere. Your health was never a problem in writing.
I never had any problem. The heart attack was really mild. Okay. Nothing. Didn't have any effect on anything.
With all the traveling you did, were there any cities you thought, I wouldn't mind staying here if the circumstances were right, if I was retired?
I always liked San Francisco.
And when did you retire from NYU?
1919. Get my little books over there. You know, I had a stroke. I can't remember stuff.
But every researcher, this one?
Yeah.
Written down. That's the best memory is when you write it down.
It's too much, ever, always has been too much for me to remember all these particular dates.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm asking is I'm curious, when did the CD come out? It was an album.
That's a whole different
That's
story.
Right, it is. That's the audio version.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with it.
Oh, so you didn't get any royalties for the CD?
Some, but not a lot.
And what about for the album? That was before the CD. It was an album.
Oh, that old album?
Yeah.
It never sold anything. I retired in 1991.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And when did the CD come out? Because that regenerated a lot of interest for the younger
not
set.
So much.
No,
sell
I love that CD.
You're talking about CD or
the CD?
Oh, yeah, not the record.
No.
I had nothing to do with the CDs, the CD or the tapes. Neil McCabe and Henry Thomas.
Right. He wrote the Walter Johnson book?
Yes, and Neil McCabe wrote a picture book called The Golden Age of Baseball or something like that. And it was a collection of pictures of Charles Conlon.
Oh, the Conlon collection.
Yeah,
you
that was.
That
yeah, he wrote that, and it was a good book. And so was Henry's book about his grandfather. They, by themselves, independently, decided they would take the old tapes that I had done and make a CD or cassette out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And course, I didn't own them. I had given all of this stuff to the Hall of Fame. And when you give something to the Hall of Fame, you assign it all out over to them. You're not saying, you keep it for me, but whenever I want to use it, it's my business. You can't. So when you give something to them like this, and they ask for it very early, and they've taken very good care of them. So I said to Henry and Neil, I don't own it. You can do whatever you want. And so they went up to the Hall of Fame. And what's his name?
Jim Gates?
No.
Before Jim Gates?
No, you never do remember his name.
Paul Guilfoyle?
No. He's the
man. Bill.
He's the man in charge of the tape library. The audio library.
Mm-hmm. You're right, I never do remember.
No. And so they asked him, or consulted with him, as to why maybe we could arrange something so they could do what they wanted to do. And so the hall and myself, I didn't, I thought it was their job, not mankind. And so we came to an agreement. I think the agreement is it's all academic in a sense because he never made any money.
But the CD, well, finish the agreement, then I want to
say
something.
Yeah, the agreement was, I think, Henry and Neil each get 30% of the royalties, and that's 60, and the Hall of Fame gets 20, and I get 20% of the royalties. But as I say, it's all academic, because although a lot of people love the tapes, they didn't sell.
But doesn't it make the book sell more? Isn't there a new interest in the book itself?
Maybe, but the book is old, always since the mid-80s, when it sort of got a new life when I had those book for people. Not like that, but the who published that book has been so many publishers. Morrow. When Morrow decided with these additional people to put out a nice edition of paperback. Up to then, the paperback was a little thing in which the pictures were tiny and the print was blurry. It was a cheap version. And then they put out this very nice view version, and they sold it for $10, and that's when it took off.
And it's still on Amazon.com.
It sells about every year between 5,000 and 8,000 copies.
So it's not going to go out of print anymore.
Who knows about the future? You never can tell. It might be a precipitous drop in sales, right?
If they go on strike, it might be. No, actually, that would increase sales because people will want to read about the good old days.
Yes, it never has been affected by strikes.
Mm-hmm. If there was a few players you would interview today, who would they be? Today's ball players, or since the last time you interviewed players?
Oh, goodness.
If you weren't a celebrity.
I have not been interested in doing that. No.
Would want to interview Derek Jeter. I think you would.
You think so?
Yes, because he comes from an unusual background. He
plays. Over Jose.
Yes.
I think Jose Canseco would be more fun.
He's insisting on writing that tell-all book.
Yes, he'd be more fun, I think, than Derek is becoming. I like he's a very nice person, but he's become a too PR conscious.
The predictable, he knows what to say.
He wants to guard his image.
Yeah.
I think that, what's his name, David Wells?
Mm-hmm. Well.
He would be much more fun.
And maybe Roger Clemens too.
Since he threw that bat at that's right.
I agree with you. Okay.
No, I think David Wells would be great fun. And also, what's the name of the Phillies manager?
Larry Bowen.
He'd be frightened.
Oh, yes, he would. He'd walk out a few times, I think, depending
on
the question. So,
no, Derek is a bad choice. He's too prominent. And you notice, by the way, I didn't choose people who were in the Hall of Fame, actually, when it came right down to it. The less reputation they had, the more they were anxious to be interviewed, and the more they were ecstatic about being interviewed because they had been forgotten. And now, since then, a lot of them are in the Hall of Fame, but that was after the book, Goose Goslin, Rube Markwood, Harry Hooper, all of them have been people elected to the Hall of Fame after the book came out.
Mm-hmm. And that has more value because you got them when they were still, before they became image conscious.
So it's important to not get people. Now, Lefty O'Drewell, he was famous, but he didn't affect him. And Sam Corfitt had been a hermit. He didn't even know he was famous, almost. So the chief was unaffected. I got people who were not, and I think it was deliberate, who were not overgrown with their own sense of importance.
And that era, it was very rare to have a swollen head. Not just
yes,
because
that's
they
right.
were underdogs compared to labor.
The Goose said that Al Simmons had a swelled head.